Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 101, we'll be taking a look at Obama's whirlwind visit to Europe over the past week.
Having the American president come here and be invited to do what he did, to address both houses of parliament, it was, in its own way, a bit of history. And he delivered.
That was Anthony Fiola, London bureau chief for The Washington Post. And we'll be asking the new MD of Waterstones what he'll be doing to overhaul the chain of bookstores.
Who would you bet on, really? Would you bet on the guys who can interact with their customers, build their loyalty, give them a browsing environment, and then integrate that with a dynamic internet offering? Or would you bet on the guys who sell on price?
That was James Daunt of Daunt Books and now Waterstones. And later in the program, we'll talk to Hilary Lawson, director of How the Light Gets In, the philosophy and music festival that kicked off in Hay-on-Wye, Wales, this week.
We're obviously trying to talk about the underlying ideas, the sort of new radical edge of where the future might be. And in order to do that, you have to try and create a space where people can genuinely talk to each other.
And now, from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, May 29th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brûlé, along with Andrew Tuck and Mr. Robert Bound. Who should I start with today? You're sort of limbering up over there, Rob, but that doesn't mean I'm going to talk to you first.
Why?
Hi, Andrew.
Hi. It did sound like you were going to be called into the office, though. Who would I start with first? who's going to be told off first?
Rob looks like he was sort of gearing for a punch-up just now.
I was cracking my knuckles. You can hear that. They haven't turned up the mics enough.
You're sort of raring to go for Venice, aren't you?
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's going to happen in Venice?
Oh, you know. Fall off a boat.
No, I don't.
Look at some paintings.
we're making a film, actually.
Right. Like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think I'm really excited about this year. It'd be nice to sort of see how... One of the ideas of the film, anyway, is how the art market affects the Biennale, how the Biennale affects the art market. Because that's something that people don't tend to talk about or like to ask about. So I think that's quite interesting.
Mm. But
I think there's kind of different...
Take your time.
Is this not the culture section? Have we not done it?
No, actually not yet.
I thought we'd spun the wheel and we were doing the sections in different orders.
Can I just say, aside from
the
ongoing land grab that happens with my desk on the editorial floor, you've actually done a bit of a land grab on today's program. We've got the festival at Hay-on-Wye, and we've got your regular section. And I'd also say that James Daunt, when he comes into studio, it also sort of falls into your patch as well. So well done.
Thanks.
I'm going to talk to Andrew now.
I've got a little patch in comparison to that.
What have you got?
I don't think I've got much, have I?
You don't actually today.
No, I'm going to just chip in wherever I feel like it.
Andrew?
Yes.
How's this week been? It's been a mammoth week.
It's been one of the biggest issues.
Baby mammoth.
It's one of the biggest issues we've done for a very long time, doing a double issue for July, August. Some 300 pages.
Really?
Yes.
I only saw 250 on the flat plan. Where did you put the other 50?
Well, we don't want you to see them.
That's because some pages don't get numbered these days.
Oh, really?
The special sections.
Why would that be?
Because retail pages, for example.
Oh, right. Okay. That's good.
But I'm assuring you it adds up to a grand total of 300.
It's a sumptuous looking issue. And we'll keep it under our hats for the moment. But we will be announcing The Most Livable City very soon. But we know it, don't we? Do you even know it, Rob?
I do.
You do? Yeah. Okay, good.
Don't tell him.
No, exactly.
Good.
Okay, good. And it was a week ago now that we had an interesting round of drinks, didn't we?
Yes.
Up in my office.
With Ambassador Marshall, who's the head of protocol for Obama.
Which was quite amazing that to have this very interesting and very chic visitor from the State Department. Are you paying attention, Rob?
Yeah.
The word chic. I know you're sort of...
You're tying your tie.
Think, oh, God, I've got up my game over there. Yeah. Now, Ambassador Marshall came to visit us. I was actually wondering if we were doing an audition and we failed because... Well, I sort of have an idea why she wanted to visit because she was, of course, very interested in our brand, etc. And then I heard about the fancy return dinner that they had after the state dinner at Buckingham Palace and all the glittering people that were invited. Andrew and I weren't on the list.
No, but I hear there's only 120 of them.
Right.
So I don't think it needs to feel too bad.
Okay.
And to be honest...
Why was Tom Hanks on the list?
Because he's one of those nice American actors who everybody kind of likes.
He's so nice that his initials are Thanks.
Was he in town making a movie, Rob? Do you know?
I don't know.
What's happening?
I think
with the
Andrew's
desk?
Right. I don't know. I didn't get tipped off about his presence.
Right.
But I think he's one of those. He is sort of. He's like. Oh, he's so nice, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's like sort of America's Stephen Fry, isn't he?
Yeah. Tim Burton and Helen.
Helen Bonham Carter.
Yes.
Helen. Helen to
and
a friend.
The only reason they were there is because their favorite pub around the corner from our office is closed. It's being renovated right now. Don't they go to that place 1881 or whatever it's called?
Oh,
you normally see them up front there, but it's under Renner. Yeah, and Helena Bonham.
I've seen Amy Winehouse in there.
Have you?
Tiny, huge hair.
Quite a smart. I don't think they're going to like it anymore, though, because it's gone all smart now.
I haven't been in there. Is it still being renovated?
I think it's still being renovated.
This could be
the opening weekend. I might have missed it. You know how much I love pubs.
Well, it's on your street. You should be basically.
I know, but
don't make that face.
I'm not making a face.
you know how you like going down the pub of an evening.
Absolutely. I had to complain to Ambassador Marshall because we were trying to have our editor's dinner, you know, that we do sort of every other month for some of our favorite clients and friends. And there's bloody choppers. We couldn't even hear ourselves over dinner. So I had to send her a note. And I said, could you please move the choppers? I mean, I know you're having your dinner at the moment, but I said, I can't hear my guests. So she moved them, which is good. It's quite noisy, though, early in the week because when they all sort of split town, though.
Yeah, and what was great was on last Saturday when they were doing these massive rehearsals for bringing in Obama from Stansted Airport to Buckingham Palace, and you just saw these planes, helicopters going over again. What are you laughing for? Is it the word chopper has made you laugh?
It's all it takes, isn't it, Rob?
One big chopper. And
it wasn't chopper. Okay. Sorry.
What did you make of the visit, though, Andrew?
It's not just
visit to London, but also in Dublin for the G8. Whether this was, was it a story on this side of the Atlantic, or was it? We have a guest coming up, and we'll see how it played on the opposite side of the Atlantic. But
I think it was a story on the side of the Atlantic. I think you felt for Prime Minister Cameron because you just can't kind of beat that kind of star power when it rolls into town. Yeah, he was the act, and it was amazing to see British parliamentarians kind of hushed and listening to every word that he had to say. But me and Rob were watching it, we were very intrigued by how much of what seemed casual was actually very planned out. So, you know, that if one of them was in shirt sleeves, Cameron, then Obama would be it as well. So obviously their teams have said, like, you know, this is a jacket off moment and you roll your sleeves. And it was all so meticulously done to look casual. And
what would you have done, Rob?
What, how'd I have dressed?
Yeah, you said, no, I'm not going to roll up my sleeves.
Well, I'm going to keep my tie on. I mean, this sleeves rolling
I
up
thought
thing, it was also at, it wasn't over the elbow sleeve rolling.
Right.
Actually, if you're hot.
Yes.
It was like pub landlord length. So that, you know what I mean? Just that fold there. Like
yes.
That. Just the sort of, if it were foot, it would be your calf, that length. But they both obviously had to do the same thing. So that took place during the table tennis in South London. And it took place during the barbecue, which they not only ate, but served, which was really strange. I thought that was maybe a bit of kind of like matiness too far. I mean,
yeah,
these
so
are
do you
the
think the whole thing was
lacking
in substance?
Well, I wonder what work they did. There was a sort of shot that was released, which was of Barack in the cabinet office with you know, his secretaries of state in the cabinet. And
do you think there was that post-Osama high five moment that we didn't see?
But yeah, possibly. Well, David blowing on his hand because it hurt.
Maybe that came from the Queen. Maybe she high-fived it.
Well-known for it.
Well, maybe we should see how it did play on the other side of the Atlantic. Anthony Fiola is here. He's the London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Anthony, to start, perhaps we should jump back over to Washington. And how important was this for the news desk at the Post? I mean, you know, Obama traveled with 350 people. How many journalists were accompanying from the Post?
One. No, I mean, it was a trip that was anticipated in some ways. I'd have to say, though, that the play was perhaps not as great as you might expect on this side of the Atlantic. I mean, there's so many issues that are percolating back in Washington right now, especially in the Middle East, that overshadows quite a lot of what was happening here. That said, I don't want to underplay the importance of what happened. You know, having the American president come here and be invited to do what he did to address both houses of parliament, it was, in its own way, a bit of history. And he delivered. I mean, the speech was, if you want to step away from your cynicism for a minute, the speech was inspiring. Mm. It was inspiring about sort of this love fest that's been going on for centuries between the British and the Americans, you know, at least after, as he pointed out, the White House was burned in 1812. So, you know, there were some initial bumps in the road, but, you know, sort of he dispelled a lot of the image there that there had been some cracks in the special relationship.
Do you think, and I'll open this up to all of you, that this was a trip that came just in the nick of time? America certainly had a hard go of it, you know, over the last, you know, 3 years economically. Ditto this country. And yet, you know, when you look at sheer numbers, I'll come back to sort of the 350, and that, you know, when he was greeted, you know, by the Brits, you know, they traveled out on the Stansted Express. When, of course, you knew that there was, you know, various Globemasters that had, you know, flown in vehicles and helicopters and all sorts. And what was really striking about all of this, you know, we talk about austerity all the time in this country, and it looked rather different when Obama comes to town.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you notice, though, that was one of the issues where Cameron didn't quite get what he wanted. He was looking for, I think, some kind of an endorsement from Obama to what's happening on this side of the Atlantic in terms of the very sort of deep cutting that they're proposing. Obama didn't give him that. And if you want to take away something from this that seemed to be to fall short of what the British might have been expecting, perhaps you're putting your finger on it right there.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, do you think that there is going to be a spending spree? You know, certainly we can remember during the Blair years, there was a lot of talk about, you know, was there going to be a new Blair Force One? That never happened. And of course, when Cameron has to go long haul, he still has to fly in a specially fitted, you know, British Airways 777. I'm just wondering, when it comes to statesmanship and showmanship and everything that we saw this week, that this is going to somehow, at least, you know, if we all agree that brand Britain is slightly tarnished, that it gives them a certain license to be more creative in terms of upping their game.
I don't know. I think that, you know, Cameron's kind of put himself in such a kind of position that it would be impossible for him to kind of spend anything on any money on anything other than a bicycle at the moment. And it was interesting to see that sense of austerity actually trickled through to the royal family as well. You know, that when they met the new Duchess of Cambridge, she was in a Rees dress that had cost £100, and that was compared, you know, to the clothes that were being worn by Michelle Obama and also by Cameron's wife. There's a real just sense that the British can't be seen spending any money at the moment, and they've kind of put themselves in such a corner, there's no way that they could ever kind of start matching what the Americans have.
Rob?
Well, it seems like the PR idea of it as well, because Michelle Obama famously wore J. Crew clothes, which are of ordinary price as well.
Yeah.
So there's kind of the PR element of it. And I wanted to ask about that as well. We saw a lot of President Obama planting trees, playing table tennis, doling out barbecue with Dave.
Yeah, it was
how much practical stuff goes on these trips, and how much is it pure PR?
But how much of the PR is the intention?
Uh-huh.
And I think that's really the point here, isn't it? The point of this trip, you know, I think if you look at it from an American perspective, was to show the unity, was to show that there were no cracks in the special relationship. And to illustrate that, what better image than Obama reaching over, to hit a table tennis ball with Cameron right behind him? Although, if you saw that photo, it was fantastic. Yeah. Cameron was looking like quite the white boy there, wasn't he?
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, how much of a coincidence was it on Thursday morning? We found Ratko Mladic in a farmhouse in a village. Is it sort of, again, like finding Osama as well? Oh, we didn't know he was there. Oh, look at it. Oh, we just, yeah, there he is.
Funny how these guys just pop up,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, especially with situations like this, I mean, these things will probably be coming up more and more. I mean, the thing is, because of what happened with Osama bin Laden, we'll see them in a different context. We'll sort of see, sort of cynical conspiracy theories and all of these things. Who was hiding them? Who wasn't? Mm. And to an extent, those are questions that are legitimate questions that we need to ask.
Mm. I mean, in terms of this, quite the European whirlwind, if you look at it from, I guess, the way the foreign desk, or certainly your White House correspondents will look at it, what do you think Obama's wanted, out of this, aside from just, I think raising America's profile and saying, of course, we're friends with everyone on this side of the Atlantic, what would you see are the sort of the three main messages that Washington wants out of this?
Well, I think what they are looking for is a sense of unity that to sort of put the importance of the European alliance back into some perspective. If you notice, Obama made quite a point of talking about how this new worldview has that emerging powers like China, India, Brazil are in fact making the Americans and the Europeans somewhat obsolete. I mean, I think what Obama was saying, without actually saying it, was that, wait a minute, we're still the masters of the universe. And, these powers exist partly because this is a structure that, the Western world has put in place. And now they're thriving as a result of that. But don't mistake that for our irrelevance. I mean, that seemed to be the message, the subtext, if you will, of what he's trying to get across.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, do you think when Air Force One was flying back across over the Atlantic last night that there was that sense, or at least by touchdown, that it was a big group hug and everyone sort of feels tighter and more unified now?
I'm sure it does. And it's funny that we imagine all these things only happen at kind of a state level. But in fact, a lot of it is about kind of personal contact and whether people actually get on with each other. It was interesting that you hear that actually Obama, after meeting the Queen several times, actually it's quite a convivial relationship and they actually like each other. So suddenly those visits become actually more important once there's been a bit of warmth built up. And I think that probably, you know, although Cameron and Obama have had very different backgrounds, they are of a generation, and there is a kind of an ambition to change their nations in a way that, you know, probably does bring them something together, you know, a bit of common currency. I think.
Mm. Rob, do you think, why do you think the Queen likes Obama? She sees him as an equal?
I think he's basically as tall as Prince Philip used to be. I can sort of see that. I think he seems really comfortable when you see the video, when you see the news footage, and you see the photographs. You look at the details in these pictures because they're such good quality, and you see what you think is at least genuine warmth between these two people. Perhaps the Queen gets fed up with always being asked boring questions and being kowtowed to. Mm-hmm. And I think he seems a little bit more human.
His story is, let's face it, quite inspirational. I mean, as he pointed out, and as you probably noticed, when he was speaking in Parliament, one of the few times that they actually interrupted him for applause was when he made the point of, you know, his grandfather being in the Kenyan army as a cook for the British military. Mm. And to see that someone could go from there to here in the course of two generations, you know, you can't deny the inspirational quality of that. Mm.
And do you think, just before we go, that London's, you know, still feeling the glow? We've had the royal wedding. You know, now we've had this state visit as well. Did everyone get what they wanted of it? Certainly at number 10.
It seems that way. I mean, with the exception of what we talked about in terms of perhaps this sort of, you know, seal of approval on the fiscal reforms here in Britain. I mean, I think they did walk away from this what they wanted. The smiles were all around. It was kumbaya, my lord, the whole way. And, you know, it's precisely what they were looking for. It really is.
Great. Andy Furlow from The Washington Post, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London, and we're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Well, a little over a week ago, it was announced that the owner of one of our favourite independent bookstores here in London, Daunt Books, was appointed managing director of the UK's largest bookseller, Waterstones. But as the bookselling marketplace continues to be a challenging one, to say the least, what does he have in store for the 300-plus shops and 4,500 staff? And how does he plan to inject a sense of local back into the static high street giant? Well, joining us now in studio to tell us more is James Daunt. Congratulations in order, I guess.
Thank you very much. So,
what do you do with almost 5,000 staff and 300-plus stores? I mean, we've obviously heard a lot over the last week about going local, but it's one thing to see what you've done on the high street and in other cozy corners of London. But what happens with in malls up and down the country, not to mention transport terminals?
Well, luckily not too many transport terminals, but it is that to energise the staff, give them back the tools to become the best possible booksellers they can in the best possible bookshops.
Mm. I mean, it seems, and Andrew and Rob jump in, it just, as soon as the announcement came out last week that there was, I'm not sure if there were necessarily cheers around the country, but it was so interesting to see that, I think oftentimes people are fearful to hear about a Russian billionaire in this case coming in, swooping in to pick up this business and goodness, what are they going to try to do with it? Are they just going to strip the whole thing? Are they going to, turn it into a chain of pantyhose shops just for the real estate? And this hasn't happened. And then, the next thing we hear that you're in charge. It's fascinating, but it's also, it just seemed incredibly common sense.
Hopefully. I mean, he has the ability to look at it from the outside and happens to be an extremely cultured and personable individual, but I think also clearly a smart businessman. What I needed to convince him was that I actually had the architecture to put in place to deliver this. It's not clearly good enough that somebody at the top says, come on, guys, fill up your shops with lovely books. They need the tools to do that. And that, sadly, in a real life, is about IT systems and the whole organizational structure that you put in place. We do it on a small scale in London. And I think the principles that are involved in doing that are exactly the same, whether you are in the leafy lanes of Hampstead or trying to do it in Preston or Bury or Truro or wherever Waterstones are, as indeed they are, the only bookshop up and down the land on many, many high streets.
Mm. If we looked at booksellers of scale elsewhere, certainly if we look across the Atlantic in both the US and Canada, we've almost seen a move where, booksellers, Borders being in Chapter 11, who knows where Barnes & Noble ends up, almost forgetting what their mission is in a way, that you go into the store and they're trying to sell you all kinds of other things when you think, well, I'm here for books and maybe magazines.
Absolutely. And I think there was that failure to realize what they were doing and terror in the face of Amazon, which effectively is the major problem. And then Amazon plus digital is an even bigger problem. But as I look at it, and I presume as Alexander Mahmoud looks at it, who, by the way, has a significant interest in the online domain, who would you bet on, really? Would you bet on the guys who can interact with their customers, build their loyalty, give them a browsing environment, really, you know, capture them at that level, and then integrate that with a reactive and hopefully dynamic internet offering, whether it's digital books or the e-commerce side? Would you bet on them, or would you bet on the guys who sell on price?
Mm. And we've had this discussion before, and it was fascinating when, you know, I think it was probably, you know, a good year and a half ago, and you were saying it was amazing looking at some of the major chains, you know, up and down the country, where they were literally just almost taking a forklift and driving the books. And, you know, it was almost, everything was sort of pre-selected in many ways. It was probably done by, you know, a machine almost, that this is what's going to fly off the shelves. And everything was sort of preloaded. And as you said, there is, you know, people who are not selling on price, there is this sense of curation. I'm wondering then, how do you deliver that narrative? Because also you once remarked that you can't just fill shops with people paid minimum wage. You have to get passionate people. Can you find 4,000, you know, 4,500 people who are passionate about reading? And
you won't find 4,500 people today. You will find a significant number amongst those who are, and it's a question of building on them and training and inspiring and delivering energy into the shops. We will judge it in, you know, maybe in a year's time, more likely in 18 months' time. But clearly, I think that is entirely possible, and it's impossible at a scale, for sure.
James, I wondered about starting this venture off with Waterstones. Which side of the till has to do the most learning? Whether it's under your direction, the staff trying to educate readers or push them into reading in a different way, choosing in a different way, perhaps browsing in a different way, as they do in your shops, or whether it's up to the staff to sort of dumb down, is the easiest way to describe it, to change their taste in order to meet in the middle, to meet the average book reader, the average Waterstone book buyer in the middle.
I'm not sure, because I mean, I don't particularly mind what books I sell to people. I just want to sell the right book to people, and in different environments and different demographics, that's going to be different books. Clearly, we do need to empower the booksellers to do this and then deliver the bookshops that are sufficiently exciting browsing environments. The one thing I think we have going for is that actually book buyers and book readers are, well, they're completely promiscuous in their, I suspect, in their book buying behavior. They will come into our shops, and when they find our shops have changed and they're good enough, they will buy books.
And also, as a secondary thing, do you, when Sainsbury's wins the Bookseller of the Year award, do you think this is goddamn easy?
Well, in a way, I mean, I have slightly defended the supermarkets over the years, actually, not just now, in that I think if they will put books in front of people, it's always a limited range. But it does introduce reading and book buying to a much greater market than we can do in bookshops. And those people who start buying books in Sainsbury's and Tesco's and the like will come into our bookshops. They will be our customers. And so, in a sense, saying thank you to them seems perfectly fair to me.
I wondered if you, James, that the one of the problems for many of these giant book chains has been that the real estate they've got is just too big often. They've taken over kind of barn-like spaces, which, you know, they couldn't fill with good enough books, so they did fill it with other rubbish, and they had kind of a not very good cafe, and they sold you wrapping paper, and they tried to sell a few CDs on the side. When you look at the model, you've got the footprint that you've got for your Daunt books. They do seem more compact, and they seem more a sensible size for a bookshop, and again, they're intimate and cosy. Is that a problem when you look at some of these giant stores, thinking, my God, what do you just do with this space and stay true to our beliefs?
Undoubtedly, there's an element of the estate which they shouldn't have gone into. I'm actually a believer in big bookshops in big metropolitan areas. I think those can be remarkably energetic places. You know, you can put bars in them and you can put cafes in them, and I don't think that's at all a problem. I think they should be, you know, dynamic social spaces. But if you're in a big shopping centre somewhere in the middle of England, I'm not sure that isn't possible. There's a relatively small number of those, and the challenge for us as a retailer is to sell enough out of them to justify it. We're stuck in them. I mean, there is an unfortunate thing that those shopping centres as well have suffered and have not been great successes simply as retail destinations, and therefore, if you signed a 25-year lease and it's 20 to go, we're going to be in there.
Mm. Finally, just before we go, I'm sure that listeners all over the world, and actually recently I was on Waikiki Beach, it is quite something to see that green cotton Daunt bag, you know, just in sort of, you know, you're in the middle of the mid-Pacific and there's someone on the beach with their bag. That's a side issue. But there are so many people all over the world who are passionate about the brand. I guess people are wondering, what happens to the Daunt bookstores themselves?
Well, I'm primus inter pares there, actually. And I work in the Marylebone High Street shop. I don't work in any of the other ones. So effectively for six of the seven, nothing changes at all. In Marylebone, they're down one bookseller. They're down me. I suspect that roughly half of them will be delighted and the other half will be to some degree, you know, have to pick up the slack. People come through. I don't actually have a tremendous role in the shop other than as one of many senior people that we have who've been there around a long time, know a lot about books.
So the brand carries on?
Oh, yeah. No, that's not... I'm probably going to be... Well, as soon as I succeed, presuming I succeed, I will be back, actually, because what I love and I have... get total fulfillment from is sitting in Marylebone High Street selling books.
Excellent. James Daunt, thanks very much and best of luck.
Thank you.
Yes, to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's still culture time with Rob Bound. This is segment two for you now, Rob. What's going to happen now?
I'm going to mix it up.
Okay.
If it were a board game, it would be Scrabble. I'd have my my letter squares in my bag. I'd be juggling the bag. I'd be inviting you to put your hand into the bag. Mm. What have you pulled out?
Oh, I pulled out a letter R.
I don't know what that means. Why did you say that? I don't know what that means.
Because I was going with it.
But it was the most complicated introduction ever.
I know.
What was he meant to pull out? A tile?
I don't know. Maybe a blank one would be
okay.
Good, they're always good, aren't they?
Run with R then, Rob.
All right. There's literally nothing to do with R in it. I'm going to Ethiopia.
So you're not
going to
play us a little bit of rock and roll?
There is a bit of rock in it.
Okay, good.
Okay, phew.
So where are we going? We're going to Addis.
That was seamless, wasn't it?
Yeah, very.
I'm going to play you a track by a band called Dub Colossus. And this is the project of a man called Nick Page, who also worked with the Trans Global Underground. He's one of these people that's a bit of a fusion-y person, a bit of a Damon Albarn type, who is a rock and roll kind of person, but mixes African rhythms all with it up, and he's very good. And I've got a list of fairly unpronounceable things in front of me, which is why I just muffed that bit.
I can't wait.
The song is beautiful. It's called Wayfakir, and I don't know what that means. I did Google it, but it seems like the Ethiopian translation system wasn't working.
And so where did you come up with? Tell us.
Maybe it means pork chops. I don't know. And it's sung by Tsedania Gebremarkos, who's got the most beautiful voice. Here she is. Wayfakir, 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 wayfakir. Doesn't she have a subtle set of pipes?
Yes, she does. I wish you sounded like that.
So do I. I wish I sounded like that as well.
No, because I sort of think, imagine if I was sitting beside you in the office. That happens sometimes.
We'd never get any work done.
No, we wouldn't, but you were sort of whispering into the phone as you were looking for interviews and things.
I know.
And then Andrew would sort of kick in with the Ethiopian version of pan pipes.
Mm. What would you be on?
I don't know what I'd be on.
Like a sort of Dobro bass.
I think I'd be on a goat riding around. riding the background.
Don't be
not
the
clip-clopping goat again.
It's not a musical instrument. It's not a toy.
No.
Do you like that?
I do.
Love that.
Are you lobbying for a trip to Addis?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's nice having done that story in the current issue
to
then be listening to lots of good stuff coming out of that. It's a very closed musical world as well. You know, it's kind of lots of things seem to happen there that don't happen anywhere else. It's a musical microclimate. I'd just like to say also the album is called, punningly and brilliantly, Addis Through a Looking Glass by Dub Colossus.
Very good.
There you go.
I like musical microclimate.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's good. If you're going to open up maybe your own high street retail venture.
Mm.
I think musical microclimate would be perfect.
It would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You could have different sorts of weather on the logo.
But just off the back of our discussion with James, do you think that, given what he's doing, do you think there's any hope for someone like an HMV? Does someone have to ride in, or is that just too far gone, the black and the fuchsia logo? It almost seems like has it drifted too far now?
Yeah, I kind of think it's a bust brand, isn't it?
Right.
You know, it's sort of people would rather, in London... say, where HMV is. People would rather go to Rough Trade. People would rather go to FOP.
Right.
And I don't think HMV seems staid. It seems bargain basement. You feel like you're paying too much if you're playing standard price because the environment in which it's sold is just a bit nasty. So I kind of think that poor little Jack Russell might have lay on his back to have his tummy scratched one last time.
Andrew, you? What if they called up? They just said, well, Andrew Tuck, we'd like you to look at HMV.
Yeah, I think the music thing is just too complicated because the number of people who do just download music now and who do buy their CDs if they want them off, you know, off Amazon or something, and that the market there is for what James did with bookshops, you know, they're to produce something small and curated. Those are the places that people, you know, and we know that when we travel, whether it's Bonjour Records in Tokyo or, as Rob said, Rough Trade here, those are the kind of places that people go to now.
But is there room then for Daunt Music or a version of, in that sense? That, you know, if you had a mass in London, if you had, you know, five or six well-known stores that just did it brilliantly.
I think so. I mean, I think that's kind of what Rough Trade are doing. They're opening in New York, I think, aren't they? Mm-hmm. So I think they're probably the brand that does it because it needs to be staffed by people that listen to records and love them. Like Daunt is staffed by people that aren't there for doing necessarily a summer job or a Saturday job. They're people that read the books that they stack on the shelves and they have a say in what goes where and how they're arranged. So you need to have that. It needs to be run by people that know what they're talking about.
Obviously. Absolutely. Which means that we should probably carry on with your cultural segments because you're up again next, Rob.
Oh, I can't wait.
You're at the Monocle Weekly. We're off to the Hay Festival after this. Back in a moment. Back to the Monocle Weekly. This week, the world's only philosophy and music festival gets underway in Hay-on-Wye, Wales. Now in its third year and running concurrently with the famous literature festival, How the Light Gets In sees the world's top philosophers, writers and thinkers examine and debate the big ideas set to shape the world over the coming years. Hilary Lawson joins on the line now from Hay-on-Wye. Hello.
Hello.
To start, is there a running theme for How the Light Gets In this year?
There is. It's called New Gods, Icons and Ideas in a Changed World.
And how would you distill that in terms of lineup and who's going to be there and what you hope to get out of it?
Maybe the biggest thing that's happened in terms of our changed world has been the rise of the East in the form of the power, economic power of China and indeed of India to some degree. And one of the issues which is less discussed than the political and economic consequences of that are the impact it's going to have on our ideas. What is going to happen to the ideas of the West, the great narratives, as it were, which have driven Western culture, and where are those going to take us? We will, of course, also be looking at the specifically, you know, economic and political issues as well, but we're looking at the broader philosophical ideas. And, of course, the themes are broader than just that political one. We will include other new gods in other areas in festival. I mean, bear in mind, of course, we've got 350 events. So to try and summarize them all in a single phrase is obviously going to be misleading.
is there one author or philosopher who you've charged with the concept of saying who is going to be the great cultural superpower? Because, you know, China might have a lot of money, but it's interesting when you look at what, let's say, Taiwan has been able to do with pop music or the Koreans, or is there a handful of people who are going to look at, you know, what will happen in terms of real popular culture superpowers coming out of Asia?
Well, I think, as I say, you know, we'll have 200 speakers, and of course they'll all have their own answers to that question. I mean, of course, we'll be interested to see what Vince Cable has got to say on the subject. He's talking about the global future on the second weekend. But there are many people who would be laterally related. For example, we're talking to Philip Pullman about the role of fantasy and how that might be changing. There will be people that we're talking to about the political fallout from the situation we've been discussing and what that might be in terms of how the West perceives itself.
It's interesting. The topic is obviously you know, rather broad, but also, I mean, certainly, as you said, you know, I think the gaze of the world, everyone's wondering what is going to happen with the Pacific Rim and certainly, you know, who is going to be stepping up to the plate culturally, because obviously we've seen what's happening economically. Is that also, you know, part of a positioning exercise for, you know, for the festival as well, that taking a topic like this to also create a bigger brand for yourselves globally?
We're trying to create space. I mean, philosophy is a strange beast. It's frequently seen, certainly in the UK, something that has a slightly Monty Python quality of philosophers on a football match failing to be able to hit the ball. And what we're trying to do is shift that perception of philosophy to something where it's really engaged in thinking about what the future might be in every area of life. And we've got political and economic, but we're also looking at morality and ethics and psychology. I mean, for example, neuroscience is very big at the moment. And we'll be asking questions about whether this can be trusted, whether it's believable, whether it really does explain everything from religion to who are criminals, and you know whether neuroscience itself is a new god of the future. So each of our debates looks at what might be a new god of the future and examines what the consequences of that is, but with the overall theme running through the whole festival.
Hilary, hi, this is Rob in the studio with Tyler.
Hi. Hello.
I wanted to ask you about the sort of practical, or your hopes for the practical implementation of some of the things and themes you talk about. You mentioned Vince Cable doing a talk. Are politicians and think tanks invited to this, or is it very much a talking shop where the good of it, if you like, sort of filters down through the ether? How does it work?
Well, one of the things that we do, we have six venues on the site, and they're all quite small. Our biggest capacity in any of the venues at any one time is about 200. And that's a deliberate strategy. What we're trying to do is create a space where people can genuinely have a conversation. We're not about creating a situation in which you have some celebrities on stage and there's the public just listening. The audience plays a key part in the debates and in the conversations. And indeed, many of the people who are on the speaker in one event will be people in the audience at another event. So we create a space where people are genuinely talking about these things and not just engaged in celebrity hunting or indeed a sort of status exercise.
Are you criticizing your alma mater there in Hay?
No. absolutely. You know, the book festival has done a wonderful job in building a following and so forth. But I think in terms of what we are trying to do, you know, we're obviously trying to talk about the underlying ideas, the sort of new radical edge of where the future might be. And in order to do that, you have to try and create a space where people can genuinely talk to each other. And, of course, you know, we have a whole series of parties every evening, which no doubt helps a little bit to soften the atmosphere and mean that people properly engage.
Hilary Lawson, thanks very much for the overview.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in London. Back in a moment. You're back with Monocle Weekly, where Rob's culture caravan continues. Do you want to just reflect over those last three segments we gave you?
No wonder I was limbering up at the beginning.
I know. Hey? No. It's all
so
revealed.
You wondered why.
All revealed.
Now look at me.
Yeah. Now look at you.
All revealed.
Yeah, exactly. Just what you wanted.
I thought it was interesting as you posed the question that here you have this very established festival, and then you have almost a mini land grab going on the side. And do you think that was, maybe the people at Hay saying, look at, this is just good for tourism. And, the more we make of the brand, fantastic. Because as you're saying during the break, I mean, it's no different than sort of satellite art fairs or, Sharjah saying, let's do something, alongside Dubai.
And I guess it sort of opens out the scope of that week. Because this festival, How the Light Gets In, has musicians and it has film screenings. It has a slightly different remit or a slightly broader remit than Hay itself. Although it was interesting listening to Hilary, because it does sound, like there's a lot of sort of, Lenny Henry's doing a book, or do you know what I mean? There's a lot of TV cooks or cookery writers that sort of end up doing sort of big, the most watched, the most kind of talked about Q&A sessions aren't necessarily with canon-changing authors a lot of the time.
Andrew, are you going to be jumping your car and bobbing down to Hay?
I wouldn't mind going to some of the Hays in other cities. That's the amazing thing about the Hay brand, is just how well it's been exported around the world, from Colombia onwards. It's just incredible. Well, it's just incredible.
No, I thought someone was going to do that. Sorry.
Just let out a good whinny.
Yeah, exactly. It's an amazing brand.
That's a no. Anyway.
Well, hold on. Are you going down to Wales this weekend?
No, I'm not actually. I'm going to Sweden.
Okay, bye.
Rob, you're off to Venice.
Yeah.
Andrew, you're off where? Where are you going? Aside from, you're not going to Medellin either, so.
No, I'm not going to Medellin.
Is it Cartagena? Where do they do it? Cartagena, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in Cartagena.
Is it? Yeah?
It is.
Okay.
Cartagena.
I was checking.
I'm going nowhere, actually, at the moment.
going nowhere fast.
You're going nowhere fast. Where am I going? I'm maybe going to the Middle East with one of our commercial team.
You're on a little bit of a commercial tour.
Because now it's really hot there. I thought it would be a good time to go.
I thought we'd just
wait.
I know. Andrew came and said, oh, I'd like to go in February. I said, oh, no, the timing's not right. I'd like to go in April. No.
Are you going to
why don't you end of June, Andrew?
Yeah.
Okay. See how you feel in Doha.
I would perhaps going down the whole Gulf, which would be nice.
That'd be quite nice.
Yeah.
I'll come. Get a suntan.
We're getting Madao.
Yeah, this is the, not golf. I mean, not a round of golf. This is actually
no plaid pants, Rob.
Oh, well, I'm interested then.
You drive your little buggy.
Yeah.
Right.
Got my plus fours.
Exactly.
Actually, you could drive us a little buggy all the way down the coast. That'd be good.
Mm. I could see that.
It'd take absolutely months.
That's right with most of the hotels you stay at as well when you book into any of those hotels. You need a buggy to get to your room.
Yeah, you need a buggy.
Mm. You're just excited about going back to the Emirates Palace and the water slide.
Yes,
I'm sad I'm not joining you.
Nice.
You're welcome to come along.
Well, no, but I'm doing a tour in July, and I've got 10 days in Southeast Asia, equally sweaty.
Yes.
Okay. Right?
We'll both be a bit down.
I'll attempt to empathise with you by not turning on the aircon in my room in Venice.
Okay.
How about that?
But it does have air conditioning.
Have you
already charted your evaporetto?
Yep, that's all charged up, ready to go.
Wonderful.
My water buggy.
You've got a solar-powered version.
Yeah, you know me.
Excellent. When is the film going to be out?
Come on.
I just want to put a date to it.
I've already written in the magazine that the film will be online by the time you read this.
Fine.
So I've kind of slightly set myself up for a
film. I was going to say, okay, well, everyone can be tuning in from the 12th, it looks like. Well, that's all for this 101st edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. And if you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our site. Next week, we're in London. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Band.
Goodbye.